This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Nabil Biagio, and here's what's coming up.
And with the force of infection, certainly of the kind we're seeing, tragically seeing in India, the emergence of more variants is inevitable.
That was Dr. Aslam Dasso, leader of the Progressive Health Forum, on concerns in South Africa about the three COVID-19 variants driving infections in India. And at least six police officers died yesterday in a suicide bombing in Somalia's capital. At least five people drowned when a boat carrying migrants capsized off Libya yesterday. And the UN Human Rights Agency is urging Uganda to amend a bill to ban same-sex relations. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Scientists in South Africa say COVID-19 variants first detected in the United Kingdom and India are now circulating in the country and are likely to increase the severity of a third wave of the pandemic. South Africa's been hardest hit on the continent by COVID-19, with 1.6 million confirmed cases and almost 55,000 deaths. Now, as winter sets in, infections are once again surging. Darren Tyler has more.
Medical scientists say the variants first found in the UK and India are unlikely to replace the one detected in South Africa late last year as the dominant strains. But they're still concerned, particularly about the three variants driving infections in India. Progressive Health Forum leader Dr. Aslam Dasu explains that scientists are trying to determine if these mutations increase transmission and virulence.
The upsurge in India indicates that that is indeed the case. You would not be able to find that kind of transmission with the original founder virus, shall we put it that way. And with the force of infection, certainly of the kind we're seeing, tragically seeing in India, the emergence of more variants is inevitable.
Preliminary investigations by local scientists indicate that the imported variants, simply put, aren't as bad as South Africa's, because they aren't as good at evading the immunity afforded by current vaccines. Nevertheless, say the medical minds, the fact that the mutations from the UK and India are now here can only add to the country's COVID-19 burden. South Africa's immunization drive is yet to begin in earnest, so Dasu urges citizens to maintain protective measures such as social distancing and wearing masks.
Look, we're not going to avoid a third wave. What we can do is determine the scale of that wave through the non-pharmaceutical interventions that we're all very familiar with. There's really nothing else that we have in our armory to protect people. And we do know that you can reduce the peak of a wave and the extent of a wave just by utilizing those methods. But the third wave is upon us.
The problem is, according to Health Minister Zweli Mkhize, many South Africans have become complacent. This is putting pressure on the government to once again enforce a strict lockdown and to, for example, ban social gatherings. This wouldn't be necessary, says Dasu, if the state had a better vaccination strategy.
In short, it's woefully inadequate.
The government was forced to delay its immunization program a few months ago. This after it was determined that the AstraZeneca shot, of which it had bought 1 million, wasn't very effective in preventing mild to moderate COVID-19 in people with a variant dominant in South Africa. But, says Dasu, this excuse has only limited validity.
After that, it was clear, because it was very effective against severe illness, hospitalization and death, it should have been administered to as many South Africans as possible. Instead, we sold it off.
Like other countries, South Africa also had to pause its rollout of the Johnson & Johnson jab because of concerns it caused blood clots.
It was an unfortunate decision again. We lost a couple of weeks. That has now resumed. But our total vaccination is under 350,000. And this is of great concern, especially if we are trying to reach millions. We don't have the supply, and security of supply is a huge problem in any vaccination program, given the conditions of this particular virus. So we're in a very difficult situation going into the third wave. It would have been ideal in the past.
Dasu describes U.S. President Joe Biden's recent support of waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines as huge. The doctor believes it could result in a flow of vaccines to less affluent countries that need it most, such as South Africa, and potentially save hundreds of thousands of lives, if not more. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Gunmen stormed a mosque shortly after midnight today in Katsina, Nigeria, and abducted an unknown number of worshippers holding prayers. VOA's Hausa service reports the mosque is in Gibeah, a town in President Muhammadu Buhari's home state of Katsina. VOA Hausa says more than 40 people were taken, including women. Details of the attack remain sketchy. Nigeria has seen increasing violence this year, with attacks by the Islamist insurgency group Boko Haram, rising conflict between farmers and herdsmen, and a surge in kidnapping for ransom. Hundreds of people have been snatched this year by bandits, many of them students taken from their schools. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is urging Uganda to amend a bill to ban same-sex relations that it says would violate human rights standards and undermine public health. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The bill passed by the Ugandan parliament this past week, but not yet final, has been under development since 2015 and gone through several significant changes. Human rights officials say they are deeply troubled by the latest iteration, which would criminalize entire groups of people. Under the bill, they note consensual same-sex relations would be harshly punished, as would sex workers and those infected with HIV. A spokesman for the UN High Commissioner, Rupert Colville, notes the bill's punishment for consensual same-sex relations has been reduced to 10 years in jail instead of life imprisonment. Nevertheless, he says the Sexual Offenses Act raises serious human rights concern.
The fact remains that such relations are still criminalized. This in a country where stigma, discrimination, and violence against people based on their sexual orientation and gender identity is widespread and often committed with impunity, and given that victims are frequently too afraid to report any attack against them.
Colville says other alarming provisions in the Act include mandatory enforced HIV testing of defendants.
Such provisions not only violate Uganda's human rights obligations, but also risk undermining public health, leaving people afraid to come forward for essential testing and treatment, and so affecting critical HIV prevention and treatment efforts. It's also risking further fueling fueling HIV in Uganda and in sub-Saharan Africa.
UNAIDS, the joint UN program on HIV/AIDS, says it fears driving people infected with HIV underground will undo much of the progress Uganda has made in reducing the impact of the disease. Since 2010, it says AIDS-related deaths have fallen by 60%, and new HIV infections have dropped by 43%. Colville says the bill provides much-needed protection on sexual violence, which is something women's groups and gender-based violence groups have advocated for some time. However, the bill in general, he says, does not comply with international law and standards and must be amended. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia has met with the patriarch of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. On Facebook today, the U.S. Embassy said Ambassador Gita Pazzi had discussed the situation in Tigray with the Patriarch Abune Mathias. They also discussed the video message he released last week in which he alleged the Ethiopian government is committing genocide in its Tigray region. In the video, the Patriarch, who is Tigrayan, said atrocities had been committed all over Ethiopia in recent months, but said what is happening in Tigray was the highest brutality. Today, VOA's Horn of Africa service reports that the General Secretary of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church Holy Synod, His Eminence Abune Yosef, said the Patriarch's comments do not represent its position. The General Secretary said the Patriarch violated the Church's procedures and norms, and that the Holy Synod, the Church's highest body, has not taken any positions on the issues the Patriarch raised. The Ethiopian government launched its attack in Tigray in November, saying it was responding to assaults by the Tigray People Liberation Army on federal military bases. The government has said it is targeting the TPLF leadership and not civilians. In the face of reports of numerous atrocities, the government has acknowledged there have been some attacks on civilians and rights abuses. However, it denies widespread targeting of Tigrayans and said that troops who commit abuses will be punished. Manufacturers of breast milk substitutes, backed by sometimes questionable marketing methods, ring up tens of billions of dollars in annual sales, often to the detriment of children's health and development. In 1981, the World Health Assembly endorsed the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitute, but the promise of the code continues to be inadequately realized in Africa and beyond. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Manisha Tarane, the West Africa Director for Alive and Thrive, an international group dedicated to health and development through maternal nutrition, breastfeeding, and other dietary practices. Tarane began by contrasting breast milk with manufactured substitutes.
Breastfeeding is the ideal food for infants. It's safe, it's clean, it contains all the nutrients that a baby needs to grow, and antibodies which help prevent the infant from many childhood illnesses. Formula, on the other hand, even though companies have tried to make it as close to breast milk as possible, is not a sterile product. And it's particularly harmful when mothers use it in a way that's not hygienic, or they're not able to follow the instructions that the formula company puts out in terms of how to prepare the formula for infants.
Selling formula is very lucrative, though. I understand that historically, formula manufacturers have often resorted to highly questionable tactics to gain trust.
Yes. So, for example, in West Africa, they really interact a lot with health workers. They visit health facilities, both public and private. They try and influence health workers to promote formula. They provide lots of supplies and they donate to health workers so that they can hand it out to mothers. And this is really dangerous because, you know, in Africa, often mothers are very young when they have their babies, and the health workers is a resource for them, and it's someone they trust.
I understand that formula is an aspirational item too, a sort of status symbol that some mothers use to make them seem higher class.
That's right. A study that we did in Cote d'Ivoire showed that often formula is promoted also by family members based on social norms, based on the advertising done by formula industry.
Nowadays, of course, formula manufacturers also use social media.
Yes, formula industries have really leveraged social media platforms. They run mother-baby clubs. They run hotlines. They're just so clever in the way they market this to parents.
Governments would have a hard time competing with that.
So one of the things that Alive and Thrive has been working on over the last 12 years is really working with government on creating an enabling environment for breastfeeding. And by that, I mean working with them to strengthen policies, helping them put in place programs in which health workers provide counseling to mothers on breastfeeding. And we've been in very close collaboration with governments to really help the governments to understand what the situation is. In Cote d'Ivoire, for example, in 2019, we conducted the study to look at exposure to breast milk substitutes of mothers in health facilities, as well as through mass media and social media. And it gave the government of Cote d'Ivoire very concrete information that they could act on. So they found that almost two-thirds of health workers that were part of the study had had an interaction with the formula company, and only 8% of health workers really knew about the code. So in Cote d'Ivoire, the Ministry of Health is being very proactive, and now they're introducing a new module to train health workers on the code, which is very, very powerful.
Is the over-marketing of formula a problem throughout Africa, or is it just in West Africa, specifically Cote d'Ivoire?
It is a big problem all through Africa. The reason I mentioned Cote d'Ivoire is because Nestle has a big subsidiary in Cote d'Ivoire, and it's one of the faster growing economies.
That was Manisha Tarane, the West Africa Director for Alive and Thrive, speaking via Zoom with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Officials in Somalia say at least six police officers died yesterday when a suicide bomber attacked their station in Mogadishu. Several other people were injured. A police spokesman confirmed that two police commanders are among those killed when a suicide bomber wearing an explosive vest approached the Waberi district station around 9:30 p.m. The Al-Shabaab insurgent group has claimed responsibility for the attack. The militants have killed thousands of people since 2008, as it has battled to oust the government and enforce its interpretation of Islamic law. Zimbabwean opposition and rights groups have held an online protest against proposed constitutional amendments that would allow the president to handpick top judges. Thousands of people viewed the Thursday night rally, which was streamed online to avoid arrests amid a coronavirus lockdown ban on public gatherings. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Stanley Gwawunza, better known as Pastor G, a Zimbabwean gospel musician, sang It Shall Be Well as the opposition and rights groups started an online rally Thursday evening. Justina Mukoko, a director of a rights NGO named the Zimbabwe Peace Project, was one of the organizers of the Resist Dictatorship Constitution rally.
Should we just allow a few people to amend the constitution? As Zimbabweans, should we allow ourselves to be shortchanged? It removes a lot of the tenets that we want to aspire to get to as Zimbabweans, being democracy, transparency, and accountability. If these amendments are allowed to take root, it means that what we will have at the end of the day is a dictatorship. And this is why today we are saying #resist. Dictatorship.
The three-hour-plus rally sought to mobilize Zimbabweans to stop President Emmerson Mnangagwa from signing the amendments into law. The amendments passed by Parliament Tuesday would allow the president to appoint judges to the Constitutional, Supreme, and High Courts without lawmakers' approval. The president would also choose his two vice presidents without an election and would be able to delay the retirement of the chief justice by 5 years. Critics are accusing the ruling ZANU-PF party of seeking to undermine the judiciary. Among those who took part in the Thursday's protest was 22-year-old Namatai Kwekweza, who is already facing charges of holding a protest last year against the amendments. She said young Zimbabweans must rise up against the movement to amend the constitution, which was hailed as progressive by most countries in 2013.
These people are altering the standard by which Zimbabweans in 2013 agreed to be treated and to be governed. They are altering those standards without the consent, without having gone to the people, because they knew if the people of this country would have said no, the lockdown was taken advantage, because they knew that civil society, opposition, could not mobilize successfully because we were under the lockdown.
Tafadzwa Mgwadi, director of information for ZANU-PF, said removal of a running mate clause was meant to ensure a president can choose his vice presidents and ensure stability of the government. On handpicking of judges, Mugwadi said,
the process of appointment of Supreme Court judges in the United States of America is no different from the framework that has been put in place. This is what happens across jurisdictions just last year. The point that I'm trying to make is not to say that we're trying to follow the United States of America on this issue, but to say the justice system, justice delivery, is a technical, a task that requires maturity, wisdom, and experience.
Mugwadi is incorrect. In the United States, presidents nominate Supreme Court justices but must win approval in the Senate. Along with the online protesters, the amendments have been condemned on social media by main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, and its leader, Nelson Chamisa. However, the president is expected to sign the bill in the next few days. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Nigeria's Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, announced last month that it had put plans to regulate cryptocurrencies on hold in light of Nigeria's central bank's decision to ban them. In 2018, the central bank said cryptocurrencies were not legal tender and that dealers and investors were not protected by law. For more perspective, Africa 54's technology correspondent, Pauline Dio, via Skype, spoke with Rotimi Ogunyemi, ICT attorney based in Lagos, Nigeria.
You're a lawyer, you work in the tech space in Nigeria. There's less regulation when it comes to how things are regulated, especially in the tech space. Maybe first bring me up to speed. Is there any regulation as we speak that regulates the tech industry in Nigeria?
Thank you very much again, Paul. That's a great question. Yes, technology and regulation many times seem to have these relationship that it's almost a tense relationship. So the way we see it is usually regulation attempts to chase after innovation and after technology. But today it has pervaded, technology has moved into every sphere of livelihood, of business, of government. So in 2015, when the Cybercrime Act was passed, that was the first indication that government was extremely serious about regulating the tech space, especially because of the new threats that technology posed in the environment. And so between the Cybercrime Act, the Nigeria Communications Act, and the Nigeria Data Protection Regulation, those three form the bedrock of regulation in the technology space in Nigeria today.
When I've talked to a lot of young entrepreneurs in Nigeria or across Africa, they tell me that some governments have come up with regulation that stifles innovation. Is that the case where you are in Nigeria?
The answer to that question is really a case of government in Nigeria doing all it can to respond in a healthy way to innovation. The most recent occurrence was when the central bank issued guidelines that kind of prohibited cryptocurrencies and crypto assets transactions in Nigeria. That does not come across as being innovation friendly, but the government would argue that it's in an effort to balance security and protection of the public good with innovation.
Let's go back to a point you just made earlier. The government are trying to regulate the cryptocurrencies and coming up with these very, very strong measures. To what extent are people using cryptocurrencies in Nigeria? Are they to the extent that the government is threatened?
First of all, the adoption of crypto culture in Nigeria is growing. I believe we may not have clear data, but I believe that Nigerians have embraced cryptocurrencies and crypto assets a whole lot more than most of our African brothers, right? Now, having said that, much of the transactions in the cryptocurrency space is peer-to-peer, right? So the activities of the exchanges are not that pronounced in Nigeria as yet. So most people hold cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin being the most popular, as investment assets, as it were, right? And so it's almost the same way they hold stocks. When it appreciates, they look at its value has increased, maybe they want to trade it. And much of that has been happening peer-to-peer. So the government's action, in my view, has really done nothing to curtail the activities of Nigerians in that space. But what it has done is, for now, it has kind of stifled the growth that we would have expected to see in that space, in that we would have expected that crypto assets would migrate to become cryptocurrencies, to become legal tender. That conversation is still going. And even the National Information Development Authority have set up policy groups to study how blockchain technology can be deployed for productive use in the country.
That was Africa 54's tech correspondent Pauline Dio is speaking with Rotimi Ogonyemi, ICT attorney based in Lagos, Nigeria. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at